Harper Audio presents Just for Fun by Linus Torvalds and David Diamond, and read by David Diamond with Linus Torvalds. I'm David Diamond. During the euphoria of the final years of the 20th century, a revolution was happening among all the other revolutions. Seemingly overnight, the Linux operating system caught the world's attention. It had exploded from the small bedroom of its creator, Linus Torvalds, to attract a cultish following among near-militant geeks. Suddenly, it was infiltrating the corporate powerhouses controlling the planet. From a party of one, it now counted millions of users on every continent, including Antarctica, and even outer space, if you include NASA outposts. Not only was it the most common operating system running server computers dishing out all the content on the World Wide Web, but its very development model, an intricate web of its own encompassing hundreds of thousands of volunteer computer programmers, had grown to become the largest collaborative project in the history of the world. The open source philosophy behind it all was simple. Information, in this case the source code, or basic instructions behind the operating system, should be free and freely shared for anyone interested in improving it. But those improvements should also be freely shared. Some folks caught a glimpse of the future and didn't like what they saw. Linus's round, bespectacled countenance became a favored dartboard within Microsoft Corporation, which was now faced with its first honest-to-goodness competitive threat. But more often, people wanted to learn more about the kid who, if he did not start it all, at least jump-started it and was its leader. Revolutionaries aren't born. Revolutions can't be planned. Revolutions can't be managed. Revolutions happen. This tape has its origins in a late model black Ford Expedition in the southbound lanes of Interstate 5, somewhere in California's Central Valley. Linus and Tuva Torvalds and their young daughters, Patricia and Daniela, are accompanied by me as they travel 351 miles to Los Angeles, where they will visit the zoo and an IKEA outlet. The conversation went something like this. Now, I've got a fundamental question to think about, and it's sort of important. What do you want to get across in this book?
Well, I want to explain the meaning of life.
Okay.
So I have this theory about the meaning of life. We could, in the first chapter, explain to people what that meaning is. And then we get them hooked that way. And once they're hooked and pay for the book, we can just fill up the rest with random crap.
Oh yes, that sounds like a plan. Someone told me that since the dawn of man, there have been two lingering questions. One, what is the meaning of life? And two, what can I do with all this pocket change that accumulates at the end of the day?
So I have the answer to the first one. It's short and sweet. It won't give your life any meaning, but it tells you what's going to happen. There are three things that have meaning for life. They are the motivational factors for everything in your life, for anything that you do. The first is survival, the second is social order, and the third is entertainment. And everything in life progresses in that order. There's nothing after entertainment. So the implication is that the meaning of life is to reach that third stage.
Okay.
So I'll give you a few examples so you can kind of get the idea. The obvious one is sex. It started out as survival, but it became a social thing. That's why you get married. And then it becomes entertainment. Okay, let's drop the sex part.
No. I think this is a whole chapter.
Let's pick war instead. It's obvious it started as survival because there's a big guy between you and the waterhole. Next, you need to fight the guy for a wife. And war becomes a social order thing.
War as a means of establishing social order.
Right, and also a means of establishing yourself as part of that social order.
And now war is for entertainment?
Sure. Computer games, war games, CNN. And the reasons for war can be entertaining. But also the perception of war is entertaining. Sure, the survival part is still there. In everything, a piece of the motivation might be survival, a piece might be social order, and the rest might be entertainment. Look at technology. Technology came about as survival. And survival is not about just surviving. It's about surviving better.
How has technology progressed to social order?
Well, most of industrialization has been really just survival, or surviving better. In cars, that meant making faster cars and nicer ones. But then you get technology in a social sense. That brings us to telephone, and TV to some degree. A lot of the early TV stuff was basically for indoctrination. Radio, too.
Establishing and maintaining social order.
Right, but then it just goes past that. Today, TV is obviously used mostly for entertainment. And right now you see all these wireless mobile phones. It's basically social, but it's moving into entertainment too.
So what's the future of technology?
So what comes after the fact that everybody is connected? What more is there to do? Sure, you can connect better, but that's not fundamentally different. So where is technology actually taking us? In my opinion, the next big step is entertainment. This also explains why Linux is so successful to some degree. Think of the three motivational factors. First is survival, which people with computers take for granted. Quite frankly, if you have a computer, you've already bought your food and stuff like that. The second is for social order, and the social side is certainly motivational. Linux is a great example of why people love team sports, and especially being part of a team. But Linux is also entertainment, the kind of entertainment that is very hard to buy with money.
Okay.
It's like the law of entropy. In this entropy law of life, everything moves from survival to entertainment. But that doesn't mean that on a local level it can't go backwards, and sometimes it does.
But as a system, everything is moving in the same direction.
Everything is moving in the same direction, but not at the same time. Sex has reached entertainment, war is close to it, technology is pretty much there.
Okay, so how does this tie into the meaning of life?
It doesn't really. It just says that that's kind of the problem here.
This is the little link you're going to have to think about.
Okay, so if you know that life is all about this progression, then obviously your purpose in life is to make this progression. So what this is building up to is that in the end, we're all here to have fun. We might as well just sit down and relax and enjoy the ride.
Just for fun? Linus was an ugly child. What can I say? I hope someday Hollywood makes a film about Linux, and they'll be sure to cast somebody who looks like Tom Cruise in the lead role. But in the non-Hollywood version, things don't work out that way. Don't get me wrong, it's not as if he looked like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Envision instead large front teeth, so that anybody seeing a picture of him in his younger years gets a slightly beaverish impression. Imagine also a complete lack in taste of clothes, coupled with an oversized Torvalds nose, and the picture starts to complete in your mind. The nose, he's sometimes told, is, quote, stately, and people, well, at least in his family, say that the size of a man's nose is indicative of other things, too. But tell that to a boy in his teens and he won't much care. To him, the nose only serves to overshadow the teeth. Brown hair, what here in the United States is called blonde, but in Scandinavia is just brown, blue eyes, and a slight short-sightedness that makes wearing glasses a good idea. And as wearing them possibly takes attention away from the nose, wear them he does, all the time. Oh, and I already mentioned the atrocious taste in clothes. Blue is the color of choice, so that usually means blue jeans with a blue turtleneck, or maybe turquoise. Whatever. Happily, Linus's family wasn't much into taking pictures. That way, there's less incriminating evidence. There are a few photographs. In one of them, he's around 13 years old, posing with his sister Sarah, who is 16 months younger. She looks fine, but he's a gangly vision, a skinny, pale kid contorting for the photographer, who is probably his mother. Being born at the very end of the year, on the 28th of December, meant that Linus was pretty much the youngest in his class at school, and that in turn meant the smallest. And you know what? Surprisingly, none of it really matters all that much. Being a beaverish runt with glasses, bad hair days most of the time, and really bad hair days the rest of the time, and bad clothes doesn't really matter because he had a charming personality. Not. No, let's face it, Linus was a nerd, a geek, from fairly early on. He didn't duct tape his glasses together, but he might as well have, because he had all the other traits, good at math, good at physics, and with no social graces whatsoever. Everybody has probably known someone in school like Linus, the boy who is known as being the best at math, not because he studies hard, but just because he is. Linus was that person in his class. A nerd he may have been, and a runt, but he did okay. He wasn't exactly athletic, but he wasn't a hopeless klutz. So in the social rankings, he might have been a nerd, but on the whole, school was good for Linus. And he's grown into his nose. At least for now, he's more man than nose. Some of Linus's earliest and happiest memories involve playing with his grandfather's old electronic calculator. This was his mother's father, Leo Voldemar Turnquist, who was a professor of statistics at Helsinki University. Linus remembers having tons of fun calculating the signs of various random numbers. Not because he actually cared all that much for the answer, after all, not many people do, but because this was a long time ago, and calculators didn't just give you the answer, they calculated it, and they blinked a lot while doing so. That was fascinating to Linus, much more exciting than a modern calculator that won't even break into a sweat when doing something as simple as calculating a plain sign of a number. With those early devices, you knew that what they did was hard. They made it very clear indeed. The first time Linus saw a computer, he must have been around 11. It was probably in 1981, when his grandfather bought a new Commodore VIC-20. Since he had spent so much time playing with his grandfather's magic calculator, he must have been thrilled, panting with excitement to start playing with the new computer. But he can't really seem to remember that. In fact, he doesn't even remember when he got really into computers at all. It started slowly, and it grew on him. The VIC-20 was one of the first ready-made computers meant for the home. It required no assembly. You just plugged it into the TV and turned it on, and there it sat with a big all caps, ready, at the top of the screen, and a big blinking cursor just waiting for you to do something. The big problem was that there really wasn't that much to do on the thing. Especially early on, when the infrastructure for commercial programs hadn't yet started to materialize. The only thing you could really do was to program it in BASIC, which was exactly what Linus's grandfather started doing. Now, his grandfather saw the new toy mainly as a toy, but also as a glorified calculator. Not only could it compute the sign of a number a lot faster than the old electronic calculator, but you could tell it to do this over and over automatically. He also could now do at home many of the things he had done with the big computers at the university. And he wanted Linus to share in the experience. He also was trying to get him interested in math. So Linus would sit on his grandfather's lap, and he would have Linus type in his programs, which he had carefully written out on paper because he wasn't comfortable with computers. Linus doesn't remember what the calculations were all about, and he didn't have a single clue about what he was really doing, but he was there, helping him. It probably took them much longer than it would have taken his grandfather alone, but who knows? He grew comfortable with a keyboard, something his grandfather never did. He would do this after school or whenever his mother dropped him off at his grandparents' apartment. And he started reading the manuals for the computer, typing in the example programs. There were examples of simple games that you could program yourself. If you did it right, you wound up with a guy that walked across the screen in bad graphics. And then you could change it and make the guy walk across the screen in different colors. You could just do that. It was the greatest feeling. So Linus started writing his own. The first program he wrote was the first program everybody else starts out with. 10, print hello. 20, go to 10. This does exactly what you expect it to do. It prints out hello on the screen. Forever. Or at least until you kill it out of boredom. But it's the first step. Some people stop there. To them, it's a stupid exercise because why would you want to print out hello a million times? But it was invariably the first example in the manuals that came with those early home computers. And the magic thing is that you can change it. Linus's sister says that he made a radical second version of this program that didn't just write out hello, but instead wrote, "Sarah is the best" on the screen over and over again. Ordinarily, he wasn't such a loving older brother. Apparently, the gesture made a big impression on her. He doesn't remember doing it. As soon as he wrote a program, he would forget about it and move on to the next. Let me tell you about Finland. Sometime in October, the skies turn an unpleasant shade of gray, and it always looks as if it will either rain or snow. You wake up every day to this gloominess of anticipation. By January, you sort of wander around in a shadowy daze, if you choose to go outside. It's a season of moist, bulky clothes and slipping on the ice hockey rink they created by hosing down the grammar school field you traverse as a shortcut to the bus. But there was an indoor sport that got Linus through the winter, programming. Morfar, the Swedish word for mother's father, would be there much of the time, but not all the time. He doesn't mind if Linus sits in his room when he's away. Linus begged up the money for his first computer book. Everything is in English, and it is necessary to decode the language. He used his allowance to buy computer magazines. One of them contained a program for Morse code. The odd thing about this particular program was that it wasn't written in the basic language. Instead, it was written as a list of numbers that could be translated by hand to machine language, the zeros and ones that the computer reads. That's how Linus discovered that the computer doesn't really speak basic. Instead, it operates according to a much more simple language. Helsinki kids are playing hockey and skiing with their parents in the woods. Linus is learning how a computer actually works. Unaware that programs exist to translate human-readable numbers into the zeros and ones that a computer understands, he just started writing programs in number form and doing the conversions by hand. This is programming in machine language, and by doing it, you start to do things you wouldn't have thought possible before. You are able to push what the computer can do. You control every single small detail. You start to think about how you can do things slightly faster in a smaller space. Since there's no abstraction layer between you and the computer, you get fairly close. This is what it's like to be intimate with a machine. There are maybe three people in Linus's class with computers, and only one of them uses it for the same reasons. They hold weekly meetings. It's the only social activity on the calendar, except for the occasional computer sleepover. This is after the divorce. Linus's dad lives in another part of Helsinki. He thinks his kid should have more than one interest, so he signs him up for basketball, his dad's favorite sport. This is a disaster. Linus is the runt of the team. After a season and a half, he used all sorts of nasty language to tell his dad he was quitting, that basketball is his sport, not Linus's. The grandfather with a computer isn't really a jolly sort. He's balding, slightly overweight. He literally is something of an absent-minded professor, and kind of hard to approach. Picture a mathematician who would stare out into space and not say anything while he was thinking about something. You could never tell what he was thinking about. Complexity analysis? Mrs. Samuel Korpi down the hall? Linus is the same way, famous for zoning out. 4 years after introducing Linus to computers, Morfar develops a blood clot in his brain and becomes paralyzed on one side. It's a shock to everyone. After he dies, the machine comes to live with Linus. There isn't any real discussion about it. Let's step back for a moment. Finland might be the hippest country on Earth right now, but centuries ago it was little more than a stopover for Vikings as they quote-unquote traded with Constantinople. Later, when the neighboring Swedes wanted to pacify the Finns, they sent in English-born Bishop Henry, who arrived in the year 1155 on a mission for the Catholic Church. Those proselytizing Swedes manned the Finnish fortresses to ward off the Russians, and eventually won against the empire to our east in the struggle for control. Swedes ran the show until 1714, when Russia took over for a 7-year interlude. Then Sweden won back its colony until 1809, when Russia and Napoleon attacked Finland. It remained under Russian control until the Communist Revolution of 1917. Meanwhile, the descendants of the early Swedish immigrants are the 350,000 Swedish speakers in Finland today, a group that represents about 5% of the population, including Linus's wacky family. His maternal great-grandfather was a relatively poor farmer from Jaapo, a small town near the city of Vasa. He had 6 sons, at least 2 of whom earned PhDs. That says a lot about the prospects for advancement in Finland. Yes, you get sick of the winter darkness and taking off your shoes upon entering a house, but you could get a university education for free. One of those 6 sons was Linus's grandfather, Leo Valdemar Törnqvist, the fellow who introduced him to computing. Then there was his paternal grandfather. He was the fellow who concocted the name Torvalds, fashioning it out of his middle name. He was named Ulle Torvald Ellis Saxberg. He dropped the last name and added an S to Torvald on the theory that this made it sound more substantial. Torvald on its own means Thor's domain. There are 21 Torvalds in the world, and they're all related. They all endure the confusion. Linus's father, Nils, known to everyone as Nicke, is a television and radio journalist who was active in the Communist Party since he was a college student in the 1960s. He developed his political leanings when he learned about some of the atrocities committed against communist sympathizers in Finland. Decades later, he admits that his enthusiasm for communism may have been born out of naivete. He met Linus's mother, Anna, known as Mickey, when they were both rebellious university students in the 1960s. His story is that they were on an outing for a club of Swedish-speaking students, of which he was president. He had a rival for Linus's mother's attention, and as they were preparing for the return bus trip to Helsinki, he instructed the rival to oversee the loading of the bus. He used the occasion to grab the seat next to Mickey and convince her to go out with him. Linus was born more or less between campus protests, probably with something like Joni Mitchell playing in the background. His family love nest was a room in his grandparents' apartment. A laundry basket served as his first crib. Sometime around his 3-month birthday, his father signed up for his required 11-month army service, rather than go to jail as the conscientious objector he probably was. He became such a good soldier and such an excellent marksman that he was rewarded with frequent weekend leave privileges. The family tale is that Linus's sister Sarah was conceived during one of those conjugal visits. When his mother wasn't juggling 2 blonde-haired rugrats, she worked as an editor on the foreign desk at the Finnish news agency. Today, she works as a graphics editor. Sarah has her own business, translating reports for the news, and she also works at the Finnish news agency. Because his family members are basically all journalists, he feels qualified to joke with reporters about knowing what scum they are. He's aware that he comes off as a complete jerk when he says that, but over the years, his home in Finland hosted its share of reporters who stopped at nothing to get their story, or who made up their stories from scratch, or who always seemed to have had a little too much to drink. That's when it would be time to hide out in the bedroom, or maybe his mom is having an emotional rough spot. They live in a 2-bedroom apartment on the 2nd floor of an unremarkable pale yellow building near the center of Helsinki. Sarah and her obnoxious 16-month older brother share a bedroom. There's a small park nearby on a hill, and in the winter it's a place to sled. Another play area is the cement courtyard behind the building, or on the building itself. Whenever they played hide-and-seek, it was fun to climb the ladder 5 stories up to the roof. But no fun could compare to computer fun. With a computer at home, it was possible for Linus to stay up all night with it. Every boy stays up, quote-unquote, reading Playboy under the bed covers. But instead of reading Playboy, Linus would fake sleeping, wait for his mom to go away, jump up, and sit in front of the computer. Computers were actually better for kids when they were less sophisticated, when dweeby youngsters like Linus could tinker under the hood. These days, computers suffer from the same problem as cars. As they become more complex, they become more difficult for people to take apart and put back together, and as a result, learn what they are all about. When was the last time you did anything on your car more involved than changing the oil filter? Instead of tinkering under the metaphoric hoods of their computers, kids these days are playing too many games and losing their minds. Not that there's anything wrong with games. They were some of Linus's earliest programs. It's fun to play for a week or so and go on to the next game. For Linus, the whole point was just writing the code to make it all happen. At times, he lived with his dad and his dad's girlfriend. At other times, Sarah lived with his dad, and he lived with his mom. At times, both of them lived with his mom. By the way, the Swedish language has no equivalent to the term dysfunctional family. One of Linus's most distinct memories is of the times when his mom would have to pawn her only investment, the single share of stock in the Helsinki telephone company that you owned as part of having a telephone. It was probably worth about $500, and every so often, when things got particularly tight, she would have to take the certificate to a pawn shop. Linus remembers going with her once and feeling embarrassed about it. Now he's on the board of directors of the same company. In fact, the Helsinki Telephone Company is the only company where he's a board member. I was vaguely aware of Linus Torvalds when an editor of the San Jose Mercury News Sunday magazine asked me to write a profile of him in the spring of 1999. Linux had become something of a buzzword the previous spring, when a succession of companies, starting with Netscape, had adopted either the notion of open source code or the operating system itself. Not that I had been up on the developments. In the early 1990s, I had edited a magazine that dealt with Unix and open source issues. So there was a dusty reference sentence floating in my brain. In that reference, Linus was a Finnish college student who wrote a powerful version of Unix in his dorm room and distributed it freely over the internet. Linus had moved to Silicon Valley 2 years earlier and was working for the then-secretive Transmeta Corporation, which had for years been developing a microprocessor that promised to upend the computer industry. He somehow had a job that allowed him to maintain his time-consuming position as the ultimate leader of Linux and final authority on any changes made to the operating system. His followers had, in fact, initiated the legal maneuvering that gave him the legal ownership of the Linux trademark. But he had become something of a mysterious folk hero. While Bill Gates, everybody's favorite nemesis, was living in splendor in his Xanadu, Linus resided with his wife and toddler daughters in a cramped Santa Clara duplex. He apparently was unconcerned about the fabulous wealth that was being rained upon the flocks of less talented programmers. How could anyone so brilliant possibly be so uninterested in getting rich? Linus has no handlers, doesn't listen to voicemail, and he rarely responds to email. It took weeks for me to get him on the phone, but once I did, he easily agreed to an interview at his earliest convenience, which was about a month later, May 1999. The first question to Linus, as we sat in the back seat of a rental car, was a throwaway. "Are your folks in technology?" I asked, while fiddling with my tape recorder. "No, they're all basically journalists," he replied, adding, "So I know what scum you are." He didn't think he could get away with that. "Oh, you come from scum?" I responded. The world's best programmer laughed so hard that he coughed out a spray of Coke onto the back of the photographer driver's neck. He turned red. This would be the start of a memorable afternoon. Most acclaimed technologists, even most of the unacclaimed ones, have this immediate desire to let you know how brilliant they are, and that they are critical players in a mission that is far more important than, say, the struggle for world peace. That wasn't the case with Linus. In fact, his lack of ego seemed downright disarming and made him uniquely likable amid Silicon Valley's bombastic elite. Linus appeared to be above it all. I found Linus to be unexpectedly knowledgeable about American business history and world politics. In his view, the United States would be better served if both corporations and political parties adopted the conciliatory approach of European politicians. and he didn't have any great desire to circulate among the rich and powerful. I asked him what he would like to say to Bill Gates, but he wasn't the least bit interested in even meeting the guy. There wouldn't be much of a connection point, he reasoned. I'm completely uninterested in the thing that he's the best in the world at, and he's not interested in the thing that maybe I'm the best in the world at. I couldn't give him advice in business, and he couldn't give me advice in technology. I showed up at his house a week later at bath time. He fished his one-year-old blonde daughter out of the tub and needed some place to deposit her while he fished out his two-year-old blonde daughter. He handed the younger daughter to me, and she promptly let out a yell. His wife, Tuva, who had been in another room the entire time, emerged to help. She is on the short side, pleasant, and bears a thistle tattoo on her ankle. Soon, we were all reading Swedish and English bedtime books to the kids. Then we stood around in the garage, amid unpacked belongings, where the Torvalds discussed the impossibility of affording a real house with a real backyard in Silicon Valley. There was no bitterness about it. And, magnificently, they didn't appear to see the irony. Soon we were watching Jay Leno with cans of Guinness. That's when I realized it made sense to do a book and make this tape. And then Linus basically sat in front of a computer for 4 years. Okay, there was school. Norsen High, the most central of Helsinki's 5 Swedish-language high schools, and the one nearest his home. Math and physics were interesting, and therefore easy, but whenever a subject involved rote memorization, his enthusiasm for that subject was diminished. So history was boring when it meant worrying about the date of the Battle of Hastings, but got interesting when you discussed the economic factors affecting a country. Linus's high school wasn't one of those institutions for exceptionally smart or ambitious kids, which are common in most U.S. cities. Such schools are pretty much against how Finland works. Finnish schools don't separate out the good students, or the losers for that matter. However, each school did have its specialty, a subject that was not required but that you couldn't get at any other school. In the case of Norsen High School, it was Latin, and Latin was fun for Linus, more fun than learning Finnish and English. It was also fun to spend time in the coffee shop near school. It was a hangout for certain people, basically those who weren't hiding behind the school smoking cigarettes. The place had been a haven for geeks since the days of slide rules. Also, it was the only cafe that let students buy things on account. Linus's order was always the same, a Coke and a donut. Generally speaking, he was better in school than his sister Sarah, who was more sociable, easier to look at, nicer to people. But she beat Linus in the end because she took exams in more subjects. His interests were narrower. He was known as the math guy. In fact, the only time Linus brought young women home was when they wanted to be tutored. It didn't happen all that many times, and it was never his idea. But his father harbors fantasies that they were interested in more than math tutoring. Yes, he was definitely a geek. No question about it. This is before geekdom became sexy. Well, I guess it's not really sexy, but hipper. What you had was someone who was both a geek and shy, or is that redundant? So he would be sitting in front of a computer and be perfectly happy. For high school graduation in Finland, you wear a fluffy white hat with a black band. There's a ceremony in which they hand out diplomas, and when you come home, all your relatives are there with lots of champagne, flowers, and cake. And there's also a party for the entire class at a local restaurant. Linus's family did all that, but he doesn't remember anything special about it. But ask him about the specs on his 68008 chip machine, and he can rattle them off with total recall. Linus's first year at university was actually quite productive. He managed to earn the number of credits that one is supposed to earn. It was the only year that happened. He doesn't know what to blame for his adequate performance in that first year, but rest assured, it didn't happen again. His academic career took a sharp nosedive. Eventually, computers became his major, with physics and math as minors. One of the problems was that in the entire University of Helsinki, there was only one other Swedish-speaking student who wanted to major in computers, Lars Vercinius. The two of them joined Spectrum, the social organization for Swedish-speaking science students, which actually turned out to be a lot of fun. The club was comprised of students in the hard sciences, such as physics and chemistry. Translation, it's all guys. But they did share their club room with a counterpart organization for Swedish-speaking students in the soft sciences, such as biology and psychology. That way, they were able to interact with females, as awkward as it might have been for some of them. Spectrum had many of the trappings of an American-style fraternity, but you didn't have to live with the other guys or ever deal with anyone who wasn't interested in science. Linus studied at the university for 8 years, emerging with a master's degree. I'm not counting the honorary doctorate the university issued to him in June 2000. Every Finnish male is required to serve in the army. Linus did his army service the next year. There were two choices. You could go for the required 8 months as a regular Joe, or go to officer training school and do 11 months as an officer. It occurred to Linus that it might be slightly more interesting to be an officer, despite the additional 129,600 minutes. It would also be a way of getting something more out of it. That's how Linus became a second lieutenant in the reserves of the Finnish Army. His job was fire controller. It's not exactly rocket science. You are given the coordinates for the big guns. You read the map of where you are, and then you triangulate on where you want to shoot. He calculated that during 11 months with the Army, he spent more than 100 days in the woods. Finland has abundant woods. 70% of the country is covered with forest. He felt as if he saw it all. Linus really hated it while he was there, but it became one of those things. After it was over, it immediately became a wonderful experience. It also gave him something to discuss with virtually any Finnish male for the rest of his life. In fact, some people suggest that the major reason for the required army duty is to give Finnish men something to talk about over beer for as long as they live. They all have something miserable in common. They hated the army, but they're happy to talk about it afterward. Linus and I are sitting at the dining room table. We have just returned from a car racing batting cage place. Tuva is putting away groceries. Patricia and Daniela are in a tussle over a book I brought for one of them. I brush aside a stuffed penguin and a huge jar of peanut butter, turn on the tape recorder, and ask Linus to talk about his childhood. "Actually, I don't remember much of my childhood," he says in a monotone. "How can that be? It was only a few years ago. Ask Tuva. I'm lousy at remembering names or faces or what I did. I have to ask her what our phone numbers are. I remember rules and how things are organized, but I can never remember details of things, and I don't remember the details of my childhood. I don't remember how things happened or what I was thinking when I was small." "Well, did you have friends, for example?" "A few," he says. "I never was very social. I'm way, way more social now than I was back then." "Well, what was it like? I mean, do you remember waking up on a Sunday morning and going somewhere with your sister and your parents?" "My parents were split up by then." "How old were you when they split up?" I asked. "I don't know. Maybe 6, maybe 10. I don't remember." "What about Christmas? Do you remember Christmas?" "Oh, I have some vague memories of getting dressed up and going to my paternal grandfather's house. Same thing for Easter. Other than that, I don't remember much." "What about your first computer?" "That was the famed VIC-20 my maternal grandfather bought. It came in a box." "How big was the box? The size that would hold a pair of snow boots?" "About that size." "And what about your grandfather? Do you remember much about him?" "He was probably my closest relative, but I don't..." "Okay, he was overweight, but not fat. He was balding. He was withdrawn, sort of like an absent-minded professor, which he was. I used to sit on his lap and type in his programs." "Can you remember what he smelled like?" "No, what kind of question is that?" "Everybody's grandfather smells like something. Cheap cologne, bourbon, cigars. What did he smell like?" "I don't know. I was too preoccupied with a computer to notice." Some people remember time according to the cars they drove, or the jobs they held, or the places they lived, or the sweethearts they dated. Linus's years are marked by computers. He had only 3 computers while he was growing up. There was the aforementioned Commodore VIC-20, which he inherited from his grandfather. It was one of the first home computers, the predecessors to the present-day PCs. The Commodore 64 became the big brother to the VIC-20, followed by the Amiga, which had a particularly strong following in Europe. Those computers never became truly popular, like the PC or even the Apple II, which was already common about the time Linus played around with the VIC. In those days before the proliferation of PCs, most of the programming on home computers was done in assembly language. Computers had their own homebrew operating system, the equivalent of what DOS was on a PC. Depending on the computer, it was either a rudimentary format or a slightly more enhanced one. Like DOS, the operating system had a program loader and a basic language environment. Back then, there were no standards, and a number of companies wanted to control the market. Commodore was one of the better known of these. When Linus had gotten about as much as he could out of the VIC-20, he started saving up for a next-generation model. He had some Christmas and birthday money stashed away. Because he was born on December 28th, the two occasions are sort of melded together. He also earned some money one summer working on the cleanup crew in Helsinki's parks. Many of the parks in Helsinki aren't landscaped and well-maintained, but are more like recreational or green areas that are overgrown forests. Actually, he wasn't really into summer jobs, but he did them in those days. On the whole, he probably got more money from school stipends. In Finland, it's relatively common for people to give endowments to schools, even the public elementary schools. So starting in fourth grade, money gets distributed to students based on whatever the person setting up the fund had in mind. Quite often, the money went to the best person in a particular subject or sport, and a lot of the awards were school-specific or funded through the government. So Linus would receive these stipends every year for being the math guy. By high school, the awards got bigger. The biggest ones were on the order of $500. So that's where most of the money for his second computer came from. He also borrowed some money from his dad. It was 1986 or 1987. Linus was 16 or 17. He spent an inordinate amount of time researching the field before deciding which computer to buy. PCs weren't very good back then. So when he fantasized about a new machine, he knew it wasn't going to be a PC. He opted for a Sinclair QL. The Sinclair was one of the first 32-bit machines on the market for home use. Sir Clive Sinclair, the founder of the company, was the Steve Wozniak of Britain. He made these computer kits that were sold as Timex computers in the United States. That's right, the same company that made Timex watches imported the Sinclair computer stuff and sold it here under the Timex name. The Sinclair had this operating system called QDOS. Linus knew it by heart back then. It was written especially for that particular computer. It had quite an advanced BASIC for the time, and fairly good graphics. One of the things that excited Linus most about the operating system was that it was multitasking. You could run multiple programs at once. However, the BASIC part wasn't multitasking. So you couldn't run more than one BASIC program at once. But if you wrote your own programs in assembly language, you could let the operating system schedule them and time slice it so you could run many of them at the same time. The computer contained the 8 MHz 68008 chip, which was the second and cheaper version of Motorola's 68000 chip. Internally, the first generation of 68000 chips were 32-bit, but externally had a 16-bit interface to anything outside the central processing unit, such as memory or hardware add-ons. Because it could only load 16 bits at a time from memory, 16-bit operations were often quicker than the 32-bit operations. The architecture was hugely popular, and it still exists today in a lot of embedded devices in cars. It's not the same chip, but it's based on the same architecture. The 68008 chip, the version in Linus's computer, used 8 bits, not 16 bits, for its interface with a world outside the CPU. But even though it interacted with the outside world at 8 bits at a time, internally it was 32 bits. That made it more pleasant to program in many ways. It had 128 kilobytes of memory, not megabytes, which was huge at the time for a home machine. The VIC-20 it replaced had only 3.5 kilobytes of memory. And because it was a 32-bit machine, it could access all the memory with no problem at all, which was unheard of back then. The technology was interesting, and Linus loved the CPU. The computer cost nearly $2,000. There used to be this rule that entry-level computers were always $2,000. It's only in the last couple of years that this has changed. Now you can buy a new PC for $500. It's like cars. Nobody makes cars for under $10,000. At some point, it's not worth it anymore. That's how it used to be with computers. When computers were not something that everybody bought, there was a pain threshold of around $2,000. In the last 2 years, they have become a lot less expensive to make. And even the low-end machines have gotten pretty good. Back in 1987, one of the selling points of the QL was that it looked cool. It was entirely matte black, with a black keyboard. It was fairly angular. This was not a rounded, pretty boy machine. It tried to be kind of extreme. The keyboard was about 1 inch thick because it was part of the same unit as the computer. That's the way most of the home computers were designed. So Linus spent close to $2,000 for the Sinclair QL. Most of what he did with it was one programming project after another. He was always searching for something interesting to do. Here's what got Linus interested in operating systems. He bought a floppy controller so he wouldn't have to use the Sinclair's annoying, revolutionary tape micro drives. But the driver that came with the floppy controller was bad, so he ended up writing his own. In the process of writing that, he found some bugs in the operating system, or at least a discrepancy between what the documentation said the operating system would do and what it actually did. He found it because something he had written didn't work. Linus's code is always, perfect. So he knew it had to be something else, and he went in and disassembled the operating system. You can buy books that contain partial listings of the operating system. That helps. You also need a disassembler, a tool that takes the machine language and turns it into assembly language. That's important because when you only have a machine language version, it's difficult to follow the instructions. You find that an instruction will jump to a numerical address, which makes it very hard to read. A good disassembler will make up names for the numbers and also allow you to specify names. It also can be used to help you identify particular instruction sequences. Linus had his own disassembler that he could use to create reasonably nice listings. When something didn't work, he could go in and tell it to find the listing from a particular spot, and he could see everything that the operating system was going to do. Sometimes, he used the disassembler not because something was buggy, but because he was trying to understand what it was supposed to do. One of the things Linus hated about the QL was that it had a read-only operating system. You couldn't change things. It did have hooks, places where you can insert your own code to take over certain functions, but only at particular places. It's so much nicer to be able to replace your operating system completely. Doing an operating system in read-only memory is a bad idea. The Sinclair QL wasn't making big inroads in Europe's seventh largest nation. Because the market was so small, whenever you wanted to buy upgrades for the iconoclastic, leading-edge machine, you had to do it from England via postal order. It involved scouring catalogs until you found someone who sold whatever it was you wanted. Then you had to get together certified checks and wait weeks for delivery, this being before the days of Amazon.com and credit cards. That's what Linus had to do when he wanted to expand his RAM from 128 kilobytes to 640 kilobytes. That was the drill when he bought a new assembler to translate assembly language into machine code, the ones and zeros, and an editor, which is basically a word processing program for programming. Both the new assembler and the editor worked fine, but they were on the micro drives, so he wrote his own editor and assembler and used them for all his programming. Both were written in assembly language, which is incredibly stupid by today's standards. Linus added a few commands to the basic interpreter that came with the machine, so that when he wanted to edit something, He basically just ran his editor automatically, and it was instantly there. His editor was faster than the one that came with a machine. He was particularly proud of how fast he could write characters to the screen. The improvement made the machine feel much snappier. One of the big things Linus liked doing on his Sinclair QL was to make clones of games. He wrote clones of the games from the VIC-20 that he had enjoyed, and sometimes he added enhancements. But mostly they were not better. A better machine, not a better concept. Linus remembers making a Pac-Man clone in assembly language. It wasn't a very good clone, but he was really proud of it. The game was actually playable, and he sent it in to one of the magazines that published computer code. He had sold other programs to magazines and thought that this would be a natural. Not. One of the problems was that the program had been written in assembly language. That meant that if you made the slightest mistake copying it from the magazine, it wouldn't work. Linus wrote some of his own games, too, but it takes a certain mindset to create games. Because games require a lot of performance, you have to get really low down into the hardware of the computer. Linus could do that, but he didn't have the gameplay mentality. What makes a great game is not usually how fast it is or how good the graphics are. There has to be something that makes you play it, something that keeps you with it. It's just like movies. Special effects are one thing, but you also need a plot, and Linus's games never had a plot. A game has to have a progression, an idea. Often, the progression is just that the game gets faster. That's what Pac-Man does. Sometimes the maze changes, or the monsters get better at following you. There's a reason that games are always on the cutting edge, and why they often are the first types of programs that programmers create. Partly it has to do with the fact that some of the smartest programmers out there are 15-year-old kids playing around in their rooms. But there's another reason games are so pioneering. Games tend to push hardware. If you look at computers today, they're usually fast enough for anything. But the place you test the limits of the hardware are with action games, like some of the 3D ones that are now popular. Fundamentally, games are one of the few things on computers where you can tell if things aren't happening in real time. In word processing, you don't mind a delay of a second here or a second there, but in a game, it starts to be noticeable at a sub-tenth of a second. Games used to be fairly simple. These days, programming is actually a fairly small part of any game. There's music, there's the plot. If you compare it to making a movie, the programming component is just the camera work. So Linus had the Sinclair QL for 3 years. It took him from high school to the University of Helsinki to the Finnish Army. In the last year or so, he had discovered its shortcomings. What irritated Linus about the Sinclair QL was that while the operating system was capable of multitasking, you could still crash at any time because there was no memory protection. One task that decided to do something bad could just crash the machine. The late 1980s were the years when you could start to imagine that, yes, maybe someday your average trolley rider would own a computer, if only to perform word processing. And all signs pointed to the PC. Yes, the original IBM PCs had started flooding the shelves and becoming successful despite numerous technical shortcomings. Those ubiquitous beige creatures had the IBM stamp of approval, after all, and that meant a lot. Another attraction? The peripherals were standard and easy to obtain. Linus was reading about all these newer CPUs that could do what he wanted. It became clear to him that the 68020, which looked interesting, wasn't going anywhere. When he was thinking about getting rid of the machine, he decided to sell his peripherals, the real hard drive he had purchased because he couldn't take the micro drive 1 second longer, and his expansion RAM. But there weren't people lined up in the streets searching for such stuff, so you had to advertise in a computer magazine and pray. And that's how Linus met his good friend Yoko Viromaki, who turned out to be probably the only other person in all of Finland who owned a Sinclair QL. He answered Linus's ad and took the train from Lahti and bought some of his peripherals. Then he introduced him to snooker. Linus faced a geek's dilemma. Like any good computer purist raised on a 68008 chip, Linus despised PCs. But when the 386 chip came out in 1986, PCs started to look, well, attractive. They were able to do everything the 68020 did, and by 1990, mass market production and the introduction of inexpensive clones would make them a great deal cheaper. He was very money conscious because he didn't have any. So it was like, this is the machine he wanted to get. And because PCs were flourishing, upgrades and add-ons would be easy to obtain. Especially when it came to hardware, Linus wanted to have something that was standard. He decided to jump over and cross the divide, and he knew it would be fun getting a new CPU. That's when he started selling off pieces of his Sinclair QL. Now, everybody has a book that has changed his or her life. The Holy Bible, Das Kapital, Tuesdays with Maury, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, whatever. The book that launched Linus to new heights was Operating Systems, Design and Implementation by Andrew S. Tannenbaum. He had already signed up for his fall courses, and the one that he was most looking forward to was in the C programming language and the Unix operating system. In anticipation of the course, he bought the aforementioned textbook during the summer in the hopes of getting a head start. In the book, Andrew Tannenbaum, a university professor in Amsterdam, discusses Minix, which is a teaching aid he wrote for Unix. Minix is also a small Unix clone. Soon after reading the introduction and learning the philosophy behind Unix and what the powerful, clean, beautiful operating system would be capable of doing, Linus decided to get a machine to run Unix on. He would run Minix, which was the only version he could find that was fairly useful. As he read and started to understand Unix, he got a big, enthusiastic jolt, and it's never subsided. The academic year that began in the fall of 1990 was to be the first time that the University of Helsinki would have Unix, the operating system that had been bred in AT&T's Bell Labs in the late 1960s, but had grown up elsewhere. Much of the academic world was then growing enamored of Unix, so the university acquired a Microvax running Ultrix, which was Digital Equipment Corporation's version of Unix. It was a way of testing the waters of Unix. Linus was eager to work with Unix by experimenting with what he was learning in Andrew Tannenbaum's book. Excited about all the things he could explore if he had a 386 PC. There was no way he could get together the 18,000 Finnish marks to buy one. So there were two things he did that summer. Nothing, and read the 719 pages of Operating Systems Design and Implementation. The University of Helsinki sprang for a 16-user license for the Microvax. That meant admittance to the C and Unix course was limited to 32 students. The thinking was that half of them would use it during the day and half at night. Like the rest of the class, the teacher was new to Unix. He admitted this up front, so it wasn't really a problem, but he would read the text only one chapter ahead of the students, whereas the students were sometimes skipping ahead by three chapters. They were all babes in the Unix woods, with a course that was being made up as they went along. But what was obvious from this course was that there was a unique philosophy behind Unix. Linus grasped this in the first hour of the course. The rest was explaining the details. What is special about Unix is the set of fundamental ideals that it strives for. It is a clean and beautiful operating system. It avoids special cases. Unix has the notion of processes. A process is anything that does anything. Here's a simple example. In Unix, the shell command, which is what you type to gain entry into the operating system, is not built into the operating system, as with DOS. It's just a task, like any other task. It just happens that this task reads from your keyboard and writes back to your monitor. Everything that does something in Unix is a process. You also have files. This simple design is what intrigued Linus and most people about Unix. Well, at least the geeks. Pretty much everything you do in Unix is done with only six basic operations. They are called system calls because they are the calls you make to the operating system to do things for you. And you can build up pretty much everything from those six basic system calls. There's the notion of fork, which is one of the fundamental Unix operations. When a process does a fork, it creates a complete copy of itself. That way, you have two copies that are the same. The child copy most often ends up executing another process, replacing itself with a new program. And that's the second basic operation. Then you have the four other basic system calls: open, close, read, and write, all designed to access files. Those six system calls make up the simple operations that comprise Unix. Sure, there are tons of other system calls to fill in all the details, but once you understand the six basic ones, you understand Unix, because one of the beauties of Unix is realizing that you don't need to have complex interfaces to build up something complex. You can build up any amount of complexity from the interaction of simple things. What you do is create channels of communication, called pipes in Unix speak, between simple processes to create complex problem solving. An ugly system is one in which there are special interfaces for everything you want to do. Unix is the opposite. It gives you the building blocks that are sufficient for doing everything. That's what having a clean design is all about. Unix comes with a small is beautiful philosophy. It has a small set of simple basic building blocks that can be combined into something that allows for infinite complexity of expression. This, by the way, is also how physics works. You try and find the fundamental rules that are supposed to be fairly simple. The complexity comes from the many incredible interactions you get from those simple rules, not from any inherent complexity of the rules themselves. The simplicity of Unix did not just happen on its own. Unix, with its notion of simple building blocks, was painstakingly designed and written by Dennis Ritchie and Ken Thompson at AT&T's Bell Labs. And you should absolutely not dismiss simplicity for something easy. It takes design and good taste to be simple. In the same way, you should not confuse the simplicity of Unix with a lack of sophistication, quite the reverse. Which is not to say that the original reasons for Unix were all that sophisticated. Like so many other things in computers, it was all about games. Because that was what Unix started out being developed for. Dennis and Ken's personal project for playing Space Wars. And because the operating system wasn't considered a serious project, AT&T didn't think of it as a commercial venture. In fact, AT&T was a regulated monopoly, and one of the things they couldn't do was to sell computers anyway. So the people who created Unix made it available quite freely along with source licenses, especially to universities. It wasn't a big deal. This all led to Unix becoming a big project in academic circles. By the time of the 1984 breakup, when AT&T was finally allowed to get into the computer business, computer scientists at universities, particularly the University of California, Berkeley, had been working on and improving Unix for years under the direction of people like Bill Joy and Marshall Kirk McCusick. But by the early 1990s, Unix had become the number one operating system for all supercomputers and servers. It was huge business. One of the problems was that there were, by now, a host of competing versions of the operating system. Some were derived from the more controlled confines of the AT&T codebase, the so-called System 5 flavors, while others were derived from the University of California, Berkeley codebase BSD, Berkeley Software Distribution. Yet others were a mixture of the two. That's why AT&T woke up and sued the University of California, Berkeley. The original code had been AT&T's, but most of the subsequent work had been done at Berkeley. The University of California Regents contended that they had the right to distribute, or sell for a nominal fee, their version of Unix. And they demonstrated that they had done so much work that they essentially rewrote what AT&T had made available. The suit ended up being settled after Novell bought Unix from AT&T. Meanwhile, all the legal haggling had been instrumental in giving a new kid on the block some time to mature and spread itself. Basically, it gave Linux time to take over the market. Since I'm digressing anyway, I'd like to explain something. Unix has this reputation for being a magnet for the eccentric fringe of computing. It's a reputation not worth arguing against. It's true. Frankly, there are a lot of fairly crazy people in Unix. Not postal rage crazy, not poison the neighbor's dog crazy, just very alternative lifestyle people. Remember, much of the initial Unix activity took place in the late 1960s and early 1970s, while Linus was sleeping in a laundry basket in his grandparents' apartment. These were flower power people, but technical flower power people. A lot of the Unix must be free philosophy has more to do with the circumstances of the time rather than with the operating system. It was a time of rampant idealism, revolution, freedom from authority, free love, which Linus says he missed out on and probably wouldn't have known what to do with anyway, and the relative openness of Unix, even if it was mainly due to the lack of commercial interests of the time, made it attractive to this kind of person. The first time Linus was introduced to this side of Unix was probably in 1991 or so, when Lars Vercinius dragged him along to an event at the Polytechnic University of Helsinki. The speaker was Richard Stallman. Richard Stallman is the god of free software. He started to work on an alternative to Unix in 1984, calling it the GNU system. GNU stands for GNU is not Unix, being one of many recursive acronyms where one of the letters stands for the acronym itself, a kind of computer science in-joke that nobody else ever gets. Geeks, they're just tons of fun to be around. More importantly, RMS, as he prefers to be called, also wrote the Free Software Manifesto and the Free Software Copyright License, the GPL, General Public License. Basically, he pioneered the notion of free source code availability as something intentional, not just an accident, the way it happened with original Unix open development. Linus admits that he wasn't much aware of the socio-political issues that were, and are, so dear to RMS. He was not really all that aware of the Free Software Foundation, which he founded, and all that it stood for. Linus may not have seen the light, but I guess something from Richard's speech must have sunk in. After all, he later ended up using the GPL for Linux. January 2nd, 1991. It was the first day the stores were open after Christmas and Linus's 21st birthday, the two biggest cash-generating days on his calendar. With his Christmas and birthday money in hand, he made this huge economic decision to buy a computer that would cost 18,000 Finnish marks, which was about $3,500. It was at one of those small corner shops, sort of a mom-and-pop computer store, only in this case it was just pop. Linus didn't care about the manufacturer, so he settled on a no-name, white-box computer. The guy showed him a price list and a smorgasbord of what CPU was available, how much memory, what disk size. Linus wanted power. He wanted to have 4 megabytes of RAM instead of 2 megabytes. He wanted 33 megahertz. Sure, he could have settled for 16 megahertz, but no, he wanted top of the line.